Welcome to Blue Dot, a look at our place in space. I'm Dave Schloem. In the summer of 2018, I was contacted by Lassen Volcanic National Park and asked if I might be interested in two poets that were scheduled to visit the park. I was and interviewed Carla K. Morton and Alan Berkelbach, Poets Laureate of Texas, about their quest to visit all 62 of the national parks while they were near Yosemite. Then I became their naturalist guide to Lassen and helped orient them to the park with its steaming fumaroles, hot springs filled with extremophile bacteria, volcanic landforms, and rich history, both natural and human. We hit it off so well that day that they began sending me postcards from every park they visited after Lassen, which made going to my mailbox an adventure all in itself. At the end of their journey, TCU Press in Texas offered to publish their poems and photographs, and the result has just been released. The National Parks, A Century of Grace. It's a stunningly beautiful book, both lyrically and visually, with anecdotes and poems by each of them, along with spectacular photographs of some of the most beautiful landscapes on the planet. Carla and Alan also asked me to write the afterword to the book, which I was both honored and delighted to do. Carla K. Morton and Alan Berkelbach joined me recently from their homes in Raton, New Mexico. Carla K. Morton and Alan Berkelbach, welcome once again to Blue Dot.
Thanks so much, Dave. It's so great to be back.
I'd like to start out, I always like to find out origin stories for people. And I'd like to know from both of you, let's start with you, Alan. When did you first start to notice it's like that you had a way with words and you enjoyed using wordcraft to become eventually a poet? When did you discover that?
I discovered that when I was 12 years old. I had an aunt on my father's side, my father's sister, and she was already a published poet. And she let me read some of her work when I was over at her house one day, and I just looked at her and said, I can do that. I'd never done it before, but, you know, I had all the assurance of a, you know, a 12-year-old, and she said, okay. So she went and got me a piece of paper and a pencil, and she handed it to me, and, you know, half an hour later, I'd written my first poem. And at that point, I was like, okay, that was pretty easy. You know, it was like, it was no big deal. And it wasn't until a few years down the road in high school that I realized not everybody else can do this. It's a matter of rearranging the words and the sounds so they made sense and, you know, a lyrical sense, and they had deeper impact than just a regular prose sentence. But I did it off and on through high school, and then got more serious about when I got into college, and I had ended up taking a lot of English courses, and I talked to professors who were poets and were associated with literary organizations. And from, I don't know, junior in college forward, it's like, okay, I can do this. I can do it better than a lot of other people. So I just need to keep staying with this. And it was never an effort. To me, it was just like as natural as breathing. And it's never really stopped. There's never been a dry period. There's never been a writer's block. There's just no restrictions.
Wow.
And I'm very grateful for that.
And when you were studying, like in school, you know, when you started to formally study poetry, were there any poets that you read that really struck a chord with you that became favorites?
Well, yes, I'll admit. I mean, in high school, of course, I was grounded a whole lot in the Romantics. The Coleridge was one of my favorites in high school, and but when I got into college, I got turned on to Ovid, who still lingers with me because I keep saying, Carla, you got to read this section of the Metamorphoses. It's awesome, and got into Homer. I got into Shakespeare. I read the whole body of Shakespeare, and then it's like fell in love with the plays again. I like the sonnets, but I really like the plays better. And but mostly I ended up going back to a lot of the old Greeks. Of course, you know, I got into the whole Patchen and Pound. period, but they never appealed to me as much as the source material, the Ovids and the Homers, because I feel like everything goes back to them.
That makes sense. How about you, Carla?
Well, I certainly did not have any type of formal training at all, but as a kid, I was just that really weird kid. And I would just always have a pencil and paper with me, and I would go outside. We had 3 acres, and that seemed like a paradise to me. And the neighbors had horses on one side, and I was just always out there and just sitting. And I just knew some strange sense that if I could just listen long enough and hard enough and just learn to be quiet, that the wind would have something to tell me, some kind of revelation, even though I didn't know that word then. But I knew there was so much more to what I was seeing. And I always just kind of wrote for myself. And in fifth grade, I had this amazing teacher named Mrs. Aaron. She was at Maxie Spear Elementary in Arlington in Texas. And we had an assignment to write about our favorite color. And I was just so excited. Ran home. I wrote about white. I love the color white, still do. And I ran back and I gave it to her, and she read it on the spot. And she just looked at me and said, "Wow." And I thought, "Oh, what is this? Something that I actually wrote could draw out that response in someone." And I was hooked. I wanted to do that over and over again. I wanted people to react and have an emotion over something that I wrote. And all through school, I was always writing poetry. And in college, I really didn't study formally at all. I studied journalism because I was, worried about eating and really didn't have any formal classes on it. I kind of came to it and became a poet laureate sideways, if you will. I didn't have the formal training, but I have just such a great love of the words, and I could feel the magic from the very beginning. Dr. Seuss was just magic to me. I mean, people read it and go, "Oh, that's so easy." But you sit down and try to write perfect rhyme and meter and make it entertaining for kids. He was a genius.
Yeah. I think it's interesting that you like white the best, because that's all the colors.
Well, yeah, that's interesting, isn't it?
Yeah, it's all the colors is white. And so you just used the words that I want to talk about next, because you're both Poets Laureate of Texas. What is a Poet Laureate? Alan, can you explain that?
Well, at a basic level, a poet laureate is the highest position that a poet can achieve in a city, a state, or a country. Not all cities, states, and countries have poet laureates, and some of them are appointed by the local community. But it gets more interesting when it's a state or a country that appoints those positions, because those are usually appointed by their peers and not just somebody meeting in a city council room. But a poet laureate is usually somebody that's got a healthy and very accomplished resume, poetry support, poetry publications, spreading the word of poetry through their environment. And sometimes they have agendas, sometimes they have messages, and sometimes they don't. But the point is there's usually a high quality of poetry out there. Texas is a little unique in that they they appoint a poet laureate basically every year now, the Texas legislature does. And when Carl and I were chosen, a person could not nominate themselves. They had to be nominated by someone else. So we still don't know who nominated us. But then it goes to Texas Commission on the Arts, who does or helps the legislature with the final selection. So we were both kind of deliciously caught by surprise when we got the phone calls that we got the title.
Carla, briefly, anything you want to add to that?
Well, it's being named Poet Laureate of Texas is just one of the greatest honors I could ever have imagined. And we stand on some amazing shoulders, and being chosen out of a state as big as Texas is really incredible, because there are so many other incredible writers, incredible poets. And while what Alan talked about is that some people use the title, just have the title, and some people use their superpowers for good. but, you know, this is one way that Alan and I are a lot alike, is that we knew about the Poet Laureate, or at least I did, and I wanted it for so long, and I really wanted to make a difference with it. I didn't want it just to be a title. I wanted to go out there and fill the world with poetry.
Crater Lake Blue. It is not royal, not sky, not cerulean, though the edges bleed slightly Caribbean. It is neither sapphire nor navy, not topaz or lapis, not opal-edged glacial. It is blue. A deep, speechless blue that draws you in and stutters the feet of your mule, that leaves you stunned, unaware, dizzy from holding your breath, your mind racing its corridors, trying to name a shade non-existent until you laid eyes upon it. A born-again blue you never shed, that glimpse of God you felt. Yes, yes, you did. The silent gift of salvation, that gentle blue-hued hand of love. Carla K. Morton, Crater Lake National Park. Let's take a short break. When we come back, we'll continue our visit with Carla K. Morton and Alan Birkelbach, Poets Laureate of Texas. Their new book, The National Parks, A Century of Grace, is a collection of the poems and photographs they produced while visiting all 62 of the United States national parks. Stay with us. And we're back. If you're just joining us, we're talking to my good friends Carla K. Morton and Alan Birkelbach, both Texas Poets Laureate. They set out to visit every one of America's national parks and chronicled that adventure in their new book of stories, poems, and photographs, The National Parks, A Century of Grace, published by TCU Press. Before we get into your adventures, which we definitely will, I'd like to know, what was the genesis of this project? How did you guys decide, you know, we poets are going to go visit every national park in the national park system? How did you come to that decision that this is what we want to do?
Well, it was back in 2013, and I was in a meeting, and one of the speakers was retired from the National Park Service and mentioned that 2016 was the 100th anniversary of the national parks. And honestly, I did not hear anything else that was said during that meeting. I just went, oh, what 100th anniversary, because I'm such a nature-inspired poet. I thought, oh, these places, they heal, they connect, they do so much. I need to do something. So I started researching it, and I found that there has never been a body of literature, especially, well, a body of poetry, written to help culturally preserve and protect these national spaces, these sacred spaces. And it's never been done with all the national parks. There are individual poems out there about national parks. And there are books and there are photography books, but not a book of poetry. And I went, oh, I have to do this. I have to do this. And I thought, well, what's better than one poet laureate going to all the parks, but two? So Alan and I have been friends for many years, and we play well together. Neither one of us run with scissors, and we just, you know, we get along so well. So I called him up and I said, okay, I'm going to go see all the national parks. I'm going to write poems, take photos, and give a percentage of the sales back to the park system when the book comes out. Do you want to do it with me? And in about 30 seconds, Alan said,
yes.
Yeah. He did. He didn't think about it. He didn't. And, you know, he had a full time job at the time. And it's like, okay, we tried from then on to try to get grants and Guggenheim and applied everywhere you can imagine. But no, we were not successful. So we said, well, this is too important of an idea, and we just have to do it anyway. So we just set out and did it on our own nickel.
Well, all I can say is their judgment was poor.
Thank you. We ate a lot of beans. You know, we would go to the park. We chose Yellowstone because it was the first one named. And that was the first one. And I can tell you the moment we got there, and it actually happened to be the summer solstice, and it was the full moon, and they call it the strawberry moon. And we arrived at Yellowstone, and that strawberry full moon rose up over Lake Yellowstone, and it was like, okay, this is immediately our trip has been blessed, and we are on our way. And then we go to a few parks and then see what weather would allow us to go to the next, and just eat beans in between.
And so how long a period of time then from beginning your first trip to Yellowstone to the completion, your final, and what was the final park?
The final park was White Sands in New Mexico, because that was the last park named. And in fact, we had not scheduled that one at all. And then last year with the governmental budget, that one got included. And we realized, hey, we have just enough time to make the book deadlines. If we get to this park and get some photos done, then we can get it all turned in and we'll be totally caught up. And that was, we were lucky, because we got there and within 2 weeks afterwards, the COVID lockdown hit that park and it was closed. And while we were there, the weather was beautiful. There weren't that many people there. It was such a wonderful way to close out the whole adventure.
And not far from where you live.
Yeah, it was about, what was it, about 5 hours, Carlos?
Something like that.
4 or 5 hours.
I mean, compared to some of the places you've been, far.
Oh,
so, like, what's the farthest away from home of all the parks? Would it be in the Pacific Ocean, the islands, or up in Alaska?
Well, there are two parks. One park north of, two, right? Because two north of the Arctic Circle. And then there is the National Park of the American Samoa, which is below the equator. So we'd have to sit down with the actual paper and pen and see which one is technically farther away. I'm not sure. Do you know, Alan?
No, I really don't. But, you know, those are the top three in terms of distance. I can tell you the number four probably would be Acadia up in Maine. We drove that one. And that was just a very long drive.
And then the Virgin Islands. Yes.
Virgin Islands.
But the whole trip took us about 3.5-4 years total to complete. And you know, there are a lot of things we lost along the way and a lot of things we gained, and oh my goodness, we'd do it again in a heartbeat.
Oh, absolutely.
So when you're deciding to go to a park, what is the process you go through? Do you contact the park service to, you know, see who can be your guide there, or what exactly do you do to like plan an itinerary and figure out, you know, what do we want to experience here? Or do you just, you know, show up and take it all in? What was your game plan?
Well, it's funny how we fall into these roles. I set out contacting the park and the rangers and the superintendents. I tried to give them a several month lead, say, hey, this is what we're doing. This is where we're going to be, because we tried to set up public outreach programs as often as we could. And public outreach in the parks, that's just doing some kind of program that's free. And when we first started out at Yellowstone, we didn't even have park poems to read there, but we talked about our experience. And each park that we went to, we had more and more material. And so I would contact them going, okay, this is what we want to do. We had kind of a rough plan on paper for weather. You know, when could we get to these places? And that tended to make that solution pretty easy for us. And then Alan's genius, it kicked in then.
My role was getting us there.
Exactly.
And some of them were pretty easy. We could drive to them. We knew it would take, you know, a couple of days. But some of the more challenging puzzles were Samoa, Hawaii, all the parks in Alaska. And there were some others too that were challenges simply because they were so far away. Theodore Roosevelt in the Dakotas.
Or Isle Royale, Voyageurs.
Isle Royale, Voyageurs, yeah, Minnesota, Michigan. Those were usually 2 to 3 days just to drive. And sometimes we'd have to take ferries or bush planes. So I would basically hand off to Carla, okay, you contact everybody and you talk to them and I'll get us there. And it worked out really well. It played to our skills. And it was, some trips were harder to plan than others, but we got there.
We did. And you know, Dave, we're really lucky to have travel partners. I mean, there's not that many people that you can be on the road with for that long, that many years, and still be great friends with.
Yeah, like you said, you play well together. I got to experience you guys firsthand when you came to Lassen Volcanic National Park. And the park contacted me to tell me that you were coming and would I be interested in, you know, talking to you and being your guides perhaps. And I readily accepted because I love to show people the park. But what I'd like to talk to you about is what I observed with you was, and I found it fascinating, I was trying to think to myself, okay, you're going to go see a new park to you that you've never seen before. As poets, what is it exactly that you're doing? And what I was fascinated by was you reminded me kind of in a way of scientists. You were just collecting data and asking questions and writing things and journaling. And I could just see that you were taking all of these things in, and the observational methods that you were using, just with all your senses, and you collect all this information and you're talking about it and pinging ideas back and forth off of each other. Could you describe that process a little bit to me about like how you go about this to get the source material that these poems derive from?
That's a brilliant observation, Dave. I mean, that's exactly what it is. And scientists make great poets, by the way. But that's what you do. You use every sense in your body, and it's not just what you read before you get there. But because once you're there, you want the earth to talk to you. You want to sit and you want to listen, and it's fascinating, especially places like Lassen, where there are dates and moments that everything changes, that the world changes, that a rock was born. And that's exactly what we did. Alan came up with a great idea about getting these composition notebooks. And how many did you buy, Alan?
I bought one for each park for each of us. So I basically cleared out Walmart when it came. Everything that was on their shelf, I bought it. And we had all different colors. You know, every park's a different color.
Yeah, I can remember, you know, seeing you guys with those notebooks and just filling them with ideas and inspiration and,
yeah,
and observations and talking to each other. That's what I found most fascinating, was the discussion and things going back and forth between you. So from that gathering of experience that you have, when do you write the poems? Is it like immediately after you've been in the park and it's still very fresh in your mind, or does it take a while for this to percolate, or is it a combination?
Well, that's where we differ a lot in our methods. I wanted to, before I went to the next park, while it was still such, made such an imprint in my heart, in my eyes, and the smell of its sulfur, the feel of the rock, everything. I like to have my poem done before I go to the next one. And Alan does it. I don't know, Alan, what was your process? You can explain it better.
Every park was different for me. Some of them, like Yellowstone, I had written while I was there, basically. It was mostly written while we were still in the park. The one there for Lassen, I wrote probably, I don't know, a year and a half after we visited the park. There was a few times when we were working on the manuscript here in Raton, and I was still a few poems behind on some of the parks. And I said, give me an hour, you know, and I'll write a poem about, I don't know, let's say Rocky Mountain National Park. I said, okay, all I need is an hour to do this. And it was, you know, we'd seen that park 2 years ago, but it's like, I just have to hang on to it. And that's why we had the journals. And that's why we keep a lot of the brochures and maps and trail guides and everything else, because we refer back to them. We took thousands of photos, and I'd go back through the photos and say, okay, this resonated with me at the time. So I never had any problem really going back or writing things out of sequence. It was just a matter of, okay, which poem do I want to work on now?
And many times we had multiple poems for each park.
It's true.
And it was hard choosing. We could do a whole nother book just on our extra poems.
I bet.
It's like a faucet, you know, you're there and it's coming, and the last thing you want to do is tell Mother Muse, no, thank you. You know, you're just accepting it and writing as fast as you can.
Yeah, one of the things that, you know, I want to add to this is the fact that I think Carl and I kind of approached it the same way. Is every park, we would go into those parks with no preset notions and no agendas, and we would be totally open for any experience that park was willing to give us. Some of the experiences were a little bit extreme, and we didn't do the really hard things, you know, really hard trails, but we were still open to anything that, you know, that we could see and would fit within our, you know, bravery quotient. But then, you know, afterwards, you know, part of what you said earlier, Dave, was the fact that, you know, we would talk back and forth, is because we didn't have any ego about keeping our ideas secret or exchanging ideas, because we don't compete. You know, we're not trying to outdo the other. We're trying to do a service to the park. We're trying to say the right things that will encourage other people to go visit those parks.
Well, what I found in reading the poems is you have this kind of wonderful yin and yang thing going on between the two of you, where one writes in a certain way and evokes certain emotions and feelings, and the other is very different. And
like
then
that.
When you put them side by side, and for our listeners, and I definitely want you to get this book. If you don't think you like poetry, buy this book, and you'll find that you do. is that you're Carla's on the left and Alan's on the right. So I always like going to I just randomly will pick a park and open the book and go, okay, I think I'll see what Alan has to say about this park first. And then I'll look and see what Carla has to say. And after I've kind of taken them both in side by side, and I have not read all the poems yet, I don't want to do that. I want to just savor it and enjoy it. Is that after I've experienced both of them, it's like, yeah, I really get that. And I'll take Lassen Park as an example. Carla wrote a beautiful poem called Angle of Repose. And that's one of my favorite books, by the way, by Wallace Stegner.
Oh, yes.
And who you mentioned in the introduction in the book. And I did too in my afterword. Mm-hmm. And so as soon as I saw that title, I went, oh, God, that's perfect. And then you've got this beautiful picture of the glacial erratic there at Bumpus Hill parking lot. And you recount your adventures on Cinder Cone, which is, you know, a difficult, difficult thing to climb because it's like you said, it's, you know, it's the old two steps forward, one step back thing as you're climbing through those cinders.
We remember that vividly.
Yeah, yeah. And anybody who's ever hiked Cinder Cone or sand dunes or anything like that can totally relate to that. And then I thoroughly enjoyed that. And then I read your take, and it's like yours was about not so much the park, but somebody whose spirit is embodied in the park, and that's the story of Ishii.
I love that.
And that it's not in the, it's beautiful poem. And I love the fact that you make it clear that Ishii is not his name.
Yeah, that was the whole point. I felt like that spirit kind of was a metaphorical embodiment of that park. It's like it's wistful and it's sad, but it still lingers. That whole, so you know, maybe that's part of what's important about that park is a person can go in there and they can strip away their identity, but they never lose the core of themselves. You know, it's still, and that's kind of what Ishii did. He never totally turned loose of what was important. It's a fascinating story, and we were led to that because of you.
Yes, exactly, Dave.
And it's lingered. That idea lingered, and I had to write about it.
Yeah, his story is amazing. And for our listeners who may not be familiar with the story of Ishii, he was the last indigenous Native American to live in the wild in the United States, in the continental United States, at least for sure. And his story is tragic and heartbreaking and beautiful and definitely, you know, bound up in the story of Lassen Volcanic National Park. So I appreciated both of the poems are beautiful. I was like, wow, I couldn't think of a better way to present, you know, my favorite park than that.
Thank you.
And thank you. That's, you know, that the gift is the one you give, not me. So anyway, let's talk about some of the parks. I'd like to just bring up regions and whichever is like the first park that pops in your mind. Okay.
Okay.
Little game here. Okay. Let's start Desert Southwest.
I would say Canyonlands.
And why?
I was totally moved in Canyonlands. My poem talks about there are these fonts on the top of these sandstone areas. We climbed this trail up a ladder and we were on top. And this is, again, a very dry desert area. And these tiny little cups in the stone. And I called them fonts because they were very much like baptismal fonts, I thought, because this is what kept every creature out there alive. And we had a magical experience there while we were there watching. It began to sprinkle. And these fonts, these cups of dry rock suddenly started moving because there were tiny little tadpoles that have morphed so incredibly and that they come to life at just one single drop of water. And it was almost as if you were witnessing creation itself. I was so moved. I was so moved in that.
Alan?
Yeah, I think in terms of Desert Southwest, you know, I'd have to go towards Capitol Reef. Capitol Reef is one of the five Utah parks, but it's a small park really, and it's exceptionally beautiful. There's almost no people there. It's one of the least visited of all the parks, really, and the hiking is amazing. There's Carl and I twice went back to a narrow slot canyon, and the walls are like a couple hundred feet high on either side, and it's narrow. It's only like 20 feet across, and on one side is carved into the stone are the names of some of the original Mormon settlers who came through this slot canyon. And on the other side are ancient pictographs and petroglyphs. And it's almost like they're looking at each other. And you walk down this canyon, you can almost hear all the souls that have walked down this pathway before. We could have probably just spent days there just wandering around in that one canyon, but it's such a beautiful, quiet, and yet geographically unique place that I'd love to go back. We had a great time in our bed and breakfast there too, but that's really, that just kind of added to the experience. Capitol Reef is probably in my top 10 of all the parks.
Wow. And I should point out that, you know, for listeners, wherever you may be, who have your favorite parks, it's like, you know, every park is special. Every park is great. So it's kind of like, you know, picking a favorite. It's like, you know, what's your favorite child or what, that kind of
that's
question.
That's exactly right.
Yeah, really. Yeah, that's a problem. We've had that problem.
They're just so unique.
Shenandoah. The exploration of anguish. It's only a question of which ghosts you decide to pursue. There are more than enough wraiths of war in formation. And there are the bones of cabins where generations flourished, those settlers hoed with handles made of oak and hawthorn. They canned fruits and hunted and sang and, well, left echoes. You may never be fortunate enough to live their complete life. To have that kind of wood in your hands, to swing an axe, to build your own home, to die in the trees for what you believe. But you can buy a walking stick, invest in a compass, take a few steps into the shade of the trail. Look, but mostly listen. There are more than enough stories to fill your unfledged heart. Alan Birkelbach, Shenandoah National Park. We're going to take a short break, but stay with us as we'll continue hearing about Carla K. Morton and Alan Birkelbach's adventures over the past few years exploring every U.S. national park through their unique vision as Poets Laureate of Texas. And we're back, and thanks for listening. Our guests are the author creators of the new book, the national parks, A Century of Grace. Ellen Birkelbach and Carla K. Morton are Poets Laureate of Texas. They join me from Raton, New Mexico. Because people, when you say national parks, they get an image in their head. It might be Yosemite, the great granite monoliths of Yosemite, or Yellowstone with, you know, Old Faithful, or whatever. They get a picture in their head when they hear the term national parks. How about a park that where, you know, it kind of flip that on its head?
Well, like Cuyahoga National Park. I like to describe that. That's in Ohio. And it's a lesson park, what not to do. That's the best way to describe that. It was a terrible dumping ground. The river there had burned 13 times, and it was a blatant horrible misuse of the earth. And in Cleveland, from the turn of the century on, they were just dumping all sorts of chemicals in the river. And to have a river catch fire 13 times. And so it's not at all what one would consider with the grand view of national parks, but yet important on its own terms of, okay, this is what not to do. And that river is still polluted. You still can't go into it, but the Cuyahoga River. But you know, so each park almost has its moral lessons, wouldn't you say, Ellen?
Yeah, I'd say that's true. You know, some of them are a little more obvious than others, but you know, there's always a backstory somewhere.
Alan, how about a park? Yeah, how about a park for you that you know people might not picture, you know, national park, but you found it to be a compelling experience.
Yeah, you know, there's it's so easy to clump the parks into this vague idea of monumentalism where everything's big and there's giant mountains and big rivers and everything like that. But probably I've got two. One of them was Congaree. Where's that at, Carla?
South Carolina.
It's a swamp. Well, it's not truly a swamp. It's more a slough. It's like the Everglades where the water's slowly coming through. And it's not anything like the monumental things of Yosemite or Yellowstone. It's trees, it's mangrove and slow moving rivers and snakes that hang from the trees. And it's an absolutely fabulous, beautiful place. That's a good one where that
one
flips
of my
that
favorites.
Idea.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, we love that park. And then probably the one I think really flips the whole image is Samoa on the island of Ofu. There is no vast tourism input on that one. It's a small park. And while there are some, you know, small mountains there, it's not. It demands a change in perception about what a person thinks a national park ought to be, simply because you get there and you're not expected to do anything. There's no trails. There's no really big visitor center.
There's not a single building other than the,
there's nothing to do. Yeah. You climb in the water and that's about it. You know, that's about all. But the water's pristine, and you have to fill yourself up as opposed to waiting for the park to fill you.
Yes, well said.
And let's briefly talk about the photographs. Did you both take photographs, or who was the principal photographer for these? Because they're gorgeous.
We were both in there. I think that a lot of times that I was the ones that are, it's like, okay, is she standing in the water? Yeah, that was me. Wait, is she laying down to get that picture? Yeah, that was me. But no, we both, like the cover is Ofu, the National Park of the American Samoa. And I was there in the coral reefs, just it was just amazing looking back. But both of us, we probably had a thousand photos per park at least, wouldn't you say, Alan? And it was hard to choose.
Yeah, I think that's fair. Yeah.
Oh, yeah, I can imagine.
Yeah, and sometimes we would take photos that, you know, she's a better photographer than I am, but sometimes I'll say, there's your photo. And then she'd go take it.
Yeah, you know,
There's one of there. I want to say it's Grand Canyon, but it's got four, looks like Amish women looking back at the Crazy Horse Mountain.
Yes.
And the women never face us, but I said, Carla, there's your shot. There's your shot right there. And she goes, oh, yeah, that is. And then she got the perfect shot.
Yes. Yeah. It's very much a team effort.
Well, and, you know, after you mentioned Samoa, what's the cover photo?
That's it. That is standing. So Samoa protects the coral reefs and the rainforest and these bats, these 4-foot fruit bats that make a shadow during the day that look prehistoric. And they also protect the Fa Samoa, the Samoan way of life. That's the four things they protect there. And this cover shot, I'm holding the book up to myself right now looking at it. That was in the waters. That was, you can only take 11 pounds of luggage. So basically we had snorkels, a swimsuit, and a change of clothes and a toothbrush and our books.
But
cover photo, and that was something that TCU Press, and by the way, we are very grateful. They reached out to us while we were doing this project and wanted to publish this book. And as any writer knows, that just doesn't happen when a publisher comes to you and asks. And we are so grateful. And they really, really loved this shot of Samoa. And they said it's so different because people, the first thing that comes to their mind is not an ocean beach scene when it comes to a national park. So they liked the fact that it was so different and such beautiful blues.
Yeah, that's probably 50 yards out in the water. You can just walk out there. At 100 yards out, the water gets a little choppy because there's a line of breakers out there. But up till, you know, 50 yards out, it's waist deep, you know. And the water's so calm and smooth and clear.
Yeah, you can see the fish through that.
It was like that, the entire beach.
Gorgeous.
Yeah, you could, yeah, you wouldn't even have to put the snorkel on. You could just look through the top and see all the fish down there. It was,
sad to say we're out of time, but
briefly.
Before we go, what's your big takeaway, you know, now that you've finished this monumental project, and it's, the book is beautiful, and what you've done here is just magnificent. It's you know, definitely, you could look back if you'd never done anything else in your lives and say, we did this, you know, this is something epic. What's your big takeaway? What have you learned about yourselves and the planet you live on and our national parks that you want other people to know? Like, so what does this all mean to you now that it's finished? Alan?
Yeah, two things. One of them is, after visiting several of the parks, it became very clear that the project was never going to be about me and Carla. It was going to be about the parks. And how best can we spend ourselves to make sure that the permanence, the fragile permanence of these parks, the idea of these parks is conveyed to other people. How can we do that? How can we use ourselves up to make sure that that message gets out? And also, in terms of just personal growth, is over 4 years, I probably aged 10 to 12 years. More in terms of not only, you know, emotionally, because each park was a whole different, you know, experience, having to find a new way to think about things, but also a lot wiser, because it made me feel like I was part of a larger something. And I was also so insignificant. how could I make my voice be heard that would make, you know, everybody else pay attention? And I was just grateful that I was given that opportunity.
And then Carla.
Well, I knew it would be beautiful, but I had no idea that it would bring me to my knees. I had no idea that the world out there could be so incredible without people, if that makes sense. Our role is back and forth. We belong to the earth belongs to us. But to be able to see Mother Earth in all of her glory and know, I felt a motherly urge to protect, to preserve. And my greatest hope in all of this is that in 100 years, this book will still be on the bookshelf and people will pull it out and still feel the awe and feel the wonder and have that same urge, that same drive to go out and preserve and protect for their next 7 generations. And I also wanted to say the afterword by Dave Shlom just is the most beautiful, beautiful thing. Our foreword was by Michael Martin Murphy, and Dave, you did in the most incredible afterword and put that big, beautiful ribbon on the book, and we just thank you so, so much.
Oh, thank you. Well, it was a joy to talk to you and to experience one of the parks with you. That was a lot of fun. I as I say in the book, my joy is always taking somebody to the park that's seeing it for the first time.
Right.
Because, you know, I go there a lot, and it's a place where I feel like if you have a favorite national park, you can spend your whole life in it and not really know all of it.
Exactly.
That's the beauty of the national parks. Even if you don't get to visit all of them, if you just visit one a lot, you still won't experience it all.
No.
So whenever I get a chance to experience my favorite park, Lassen Volcanic, with somebody who's never seen it before, I get to see it through their eyes for the first time, and that's a wonderful experience. But I have to say, of all the first timers I've ever taken there, you guys were the most fun because, you know, your joy and your passion for what you were experiencing and taking it all in was just that was a lot of fun for me and very meaningful. So thank you.
Well, it was your passion, Dave, that worked its way into our souls and opened up our eyes to the park, and we are so grateful.
Thanks again to our wonderful guests, Poets Laureate of Texas Carla K. Morton and Alan Birkelbach. If you know anyone who loves the national parks, get them a copy of The National Parks, A Century of Grace from TCU Press. I guarantee it's the kind of work that will be treasured and revisited many times. And don't forget to read the afterword. Blue Dot is a production of North State Public Radio from beautiful and talented Northern California. If you missed an episode or want to recommend one, check out our archives and link to our podcasts at mynspr.org. We're also on the NPR One app or wherever you get your podcast groove on. Our theme music is by Matt Schiltz. Blue Dot is engineered and produced by the maestro, Matt Fidler. Our associate producer and owner of A Dog Named Rocket is Ellie Johnson. For all of us here, I remind you there that from deep space we all live on a pale blue dot.